It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Last week, the American Medical Association officially reclassified obesity as a disease, and we initiated a discussion with Dr. Issa Davis, a practicing physician with UPMC, about the changes this reclassification will bring to the healthcare system. We received a substantial response from listeners and wanted to invite Dr. Davis back for a follow-up visit to discuss how doctors can better treat the 1 in 3 Americans who struggle with obesity. She joins me again in Studio A. Dr. Issa Davis, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good morning. Thank you for having me back.
And if you were unable to join the conversation last time, here's another opportunity to speak with Dr. Davis. Give us a call at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is essspgh@wesa.fm, and you can reach us on Twitter at essspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Dr. Davis, let's begin with a recap of the changes that this reclassification of obesity as a disease will bring to the healthcare system.
So first, what it will do is it will allow for us to, in terms of our primary care offices, it'll allow us to have, I think, more discussions with our patients about obesity being a disease. It'll allow us to code for these sessions. It'll allow for hopefully broader coverage of insurance companies to cover resources for weight loss programs and nutritional services to help people, you know, begin to address this problem. And hopefully it'll lead to increased funding for research and also innovation of prevention and intervention programs in the community as well.
And we covered this the last time that you were here, but for those who did not hear the segment, why are we seeing so many more obese people?
You know, part of the issue has been, you know, one of the things we talked about was the increase in availability of food, particularly nutrient-dense foods such as fast food, sodas, it coupled with a decrease in physical activity and exercise, part of which when we talked about in the school system, you know, physical activity programs unfortunately are not part of the daily schedule. And so there's been limited access to physical activity for school-age kids. So those are, you know, probably the two biggest things. But, you know, this is a multifactorial problem. There have been a lot of environmental changes over the past several decades, such as increased relying on transportation, such as cars and elevators that, you know, also limit people's physical activity. So
when we hear somebody say, you know, boy, when I was a kid, we used to walk 3 miles to school, and that was just one way. There's something to be said for that, evidently.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, all right. So on to the treatment aspects of this. And is the treatment of obesity different for men, women, and children?
The general principle for treatment is the same, and it is programs that will address eating habits, and physical activity. So, you know, we usually start off with things like nutritional services where they will address calorie restriction. And then the other thing is increasing some physical activity for these individuals. But there are also, after we address diet and exercise, then there is the we usually have a behavioral component to help institute things that will promote behavioral change, as well as medications that we'll use. And then there's surgery, different surgical procedures.
Which I'm guessing is a last resort.
Yes, yes. And for people who have severe obesity.
Now, we hear so much about the importance of a healthy lifestyle, and you've talked about how people, what people can do to try to adopt it, how important it is for people to focus on eating less and being more active. So what is the healthy lifestyle, and how do we adopt it in a way that makes it stick?
So the first part, what we have to do is realize that small changes go a long way. and also that this is not something that's going to be a quick fix. This is something that we will have to manage over a long period of time. So making small dietary changes, for instance, if you drink, soda, starting with making a substitution for soda, or if you're not physically active at all, starting with just 10 minutes of, let's say, walking a day, just get into the habit of making a small change and staying with it. Usually they say it takes about 3 weeks for something to become a habit, but being consistent in doing it every day. And then once you get that under your belt, then increasing it, increasing the exercise from 10 minutes to 15 minutes and then to 20 minutes and then eventually up to the goal, which is 60 minutes per day. And same thing with eating, making those small dietary changes, cutting out soda or increasing your water intake, substituting chips for fruit, things
or
along,
fruit for the chips
or fruit, excuse me. Right. It's substituting a fruit for the chips. Exactly. But making small dietary changes will go a longer way than adopting a big, one of these fad diets that, people are drawn to where it promises quick results if you stick with it. And most people do, but then it's something that they can't sustain over a long period of time.
And it asks for things that some people look at as being unrealistic. And that is that you make these huge wholesale changes in your life. And then after a while, you feel deprived. So is the answer to people who have a hard time making changes like you're suggesting, is it to allow yourself just a little or a few of the things that you've always really liked that may be bad for you, but just in smaller quantities?
Exactly. I mean, moderation is key. But for some people starting out, though, it's getting back to honestly, I think it's getting back to the basics of eating. It's getting back to, healthy meals that are, consisting of a lean protein, your fruits, your vegetables, starch in moderation, increase in water. I mean, just getting back to, even for some people, it's getting back to cooking. I mean, I think is one of the big things. We're all so pressed for time and we look for foods of convenience. And those foods tend to be the higher calorie, the more processed foods, higher in fat, sodium, and salt. If we could just get back to cooking again, cooking our own food where you're controlling the amount of salt, the amount of sugar, the amount of fat, that's even a big step in the right direction. And, there are a lot of meals now that can be prepared in 15 to 20 minutes that are not processed. So I think it's just a matter of, putting that as a priority, the family dinner, so to speak, as a priority again. In our lives, and I think that would help a lot.
And we'll get into the nutrition aspect of weight management in our next segment as well with a registered dietitian, Judy Dodd. Our number, 412-246-2002. If you have a comment or question, do you encounter people who feel surgeries are the only way to get their weight under control? When should people have surgery? That's a question we will certainly ask Dr. Davis. But first, let's take a call from Don from Braddock Hills. Don, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello.
Hi, Don. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Are you able to hear me?
We can hear you just fine.
Okay. My question is, and I'll try to keep it succinct, is I want to know what is the relationship between obesity and obstructive sleep apnea? I ask that question because I do have sleep apnea. It's a big problem, but I'm not really a big fat guy, and this diagnosis has been given to me by my primary care physician as well as my sleep specialist. So I'd like to know what your specialist there, your guest, has to say about that.
All right. Well, thank you for that question, Don. And Dr. Davis, what is the relationship between sleep apnea and obesity?
Yes. Thank you, Don, for your question. So there is a relationship between sleep apnea and obesity. Obesity is a risk factor, one of the major risk factors for sleep apnea. What sleep apnea is, is that there's when people are sleeping at night, there is a potential for them to stop breathing for a few seconds. And then what that causes them to do is they actually wake themselves up. Most oftentimes you'll hear people snore or kind of make a gurgling sound, where the problem for people who are overweight is that there's more tissue around their neck area. There's more kind of redundancy in the back of their throat. And so when they sleep, that tissue is soft, the tongue kind of falls over their windpipe, and that kind of prevents them from breathing for a few minutes or getting oxygen, and then they wake themselves up. So, so there is a strong relationship between obesity or even overweight and sleep apnea.
412-246-2002 is the number to call. Have you or someone you know been treated for obesity through surgery? We'd like to hear from you. And how successful have you been in making lifestyle changes? On that subject of surgery, you were talking earlier about recommending surgery as a last resort.
Yes.
So when do you realize that you've tried everything else and this is, you know, when do you realize this is the end of the line?
So, you know, there's pretty defined criteria for treatment with surgery. And there are, you know, several surgical procedures. I think the most popular that people know about is bariatric surgery, so where they actually bypass do a bypass in the stomach area to make the stomach smaller, so to speak. We usually will recommend bariatric surgery for people who have severe obesity, so usually have a body mass index of greater than 40, and generally these people often have other comorbid illnesses, so diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, such that their risk of death is quite high if nothing is done, you know, pretty soon to help them decrease that weight. And so usually those are the people that get referred for surgical procedures. But realize that even people who undergo surgical procedures, there's still a six-month process, pre-screening process, where they have to demonstrate that they have made lifestyle changes first, that many of them go through a battery of screening, both psychological screening to make sure that they're ready to make this change. They are in intense dietary counseling with regards to their eating habits. They have to demonstrate that they can make those changes, and that they are adhering to a physical activity program, and that they actually have to demonstrate that they can lose weight, some weight, prior to the surgery with these lifestyle changes first. Because once the surgery happens, there's going to be a new way of eating that they have to adopt that's not going to be by choice, so to speak, because the surgery has altered their anatomy in a way that they cannot go back to the way that they previously ate. And so they have to make those changes. Otherwise, it can lead to a lot of complications and also lead to regain of weight afterwards, which would cause, you know, more problems than regaining weight after just if you fail diet and exercise alone. So, you know, they still have to have this lifestyle change first, and usually then we'll have the surgical procedure after that.
Is there ever an instance when a child would need surgery?
There is, but the criteria are much stricter with regards to children. Obviously, we don't, we don't want to change the anatomy of any growing child that has a lot of implications. But there are some, you know, for some children who are extremely obese, who have a lot of chronic illnesses as a child that would lead to an early death where they cannot engage in physical activity enough to lose weight, then it would be it would be indicated. But again, that child still goes through a series of rigorous testing and screening procedures prior to that surgical procedure.
412-246-2002 is the number to call if you would like to join the conversation. Our guest, Dr. Issa Davis with UPMC, and Let's go to the phones. We have Mark from Economy Borough with us. Mark, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good afternoon. I guess my comment goes to your guest opening statement, which effectively surrounded the idea that with this change in definition, physicians are going to be able to bill customers for the consultations. And she also liked to have this opened up to insurance companies who would be more likely to pay for these services. We have a healthcare industry that has skyrocketing costs that we're all paying for. I guess I personally believe that, and we dance around this subject, we use the word obese, where when I was growing up, it was simply fat. I'm 57 years old. There have been cars, escalators, and elevators around for as long as I have lived. It's nothing new. I think that we need to get away from this concept of, you know, trying to coax people along when this is a responsibility thing. You need to burn more and eat fewer. I mean, it's a simple proposition.
Well,
I'm concerned about the billing aspect of it, that we are adding yet another thing to an overburdened healthcare system.
Well, I'm guessing if you engage in a preventative, and I'll let you address this, doctor, but if you're preventing people from getting things that are more serious conditions like diabetes, for example, you're in the long run, I'm guessing, going to be spending less. But as far as doing this as a preemptive way of keeping people from having more difficult health problems, does this in fact address that?
Yeah, so Mark, I think your question is a very good one, and I think it is, you know, what we all wrestle with. But I think to keep in mind, we're going to spend money on this problem one way or the other, Paul, just like you brought up. Either we're already paying for it. We're already paying, you know, we as a country pay like 14 to 18% of our gross domestic product on health care costs. And yet, you know, we don't have any significant benefit in terms of our life expectancy being longer when you compare us to other countries. So we're already spending a lot of money. You know, the cardiovascular disease is still the number one disease process that we are, we spend tons of money on. The problem is if we don't address obesity up front and be able to, like you said, provide more resources for preventive services, get people into nutritional counseling that can help them eat better, to get them more physically active, to address some of the psychological components to make getting into these, you know, adhering to these programs a little bit easier. So that they can, I agree, so that they can take responsibility for their health and to, we can start to see obesity, start to be impacted in a major way. Because right now we're already spending a lot on diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, and stroke. And that number is just going to continue to increase if we don't address obesity. So as a country, we are all invested in that. We're going to spend this money anyway. We're either going to spend it on the back end and taking care of all of these people when they do get, MIs and diabetes and heart failure and all these things that obesity leads to, or we're going to put it up front and help with prevention by providing more services that can help support people with regards to nutritional services and improve physical activity. So I think with regards to coding, for physicians, we already treat obesity as a chronic illness. We already address it. The only difference is that when people come in to see us just for obesity alone, it is not coded. That visit can't be, you can't code for that visit in any meaningful way. And it's very difficult to make referrals to the necessary programs because it's not currently covered. And that's really the issue.
Dr. Issa Davis is a practicing physician with UPMC joining us in Studio A. Dr. Davis, thanks for being with us again and following up on some of the things we didn't get to the last time you were here. And happy 4th of July.
Happy 4th of July, Paul. Thank you.
Coming up, how an obese person can change their lifestyle. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about treating obesity as a disease now that it has been reclassified as a disease by the AMA. I'm joined now in Studio A by Judy Dodd of Pitt's School of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences. Judy Dodd, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you today.
You can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is esspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Are you trying to adopt a more healthy lifestyle when it comes to eating? What have you found to be particularly challenging? Call us at 412-246-2002. Judy Dodd, how do you begin to change the lifestyle of someone who is obese regarding eating?
Well, first of all, they've got to have not just the commitment of their own, but of those people that are in their environment. And this is not a single issue. I don't choose to be overweight. I don't choose to be obese. Chances are it's the culture I've grown up in that I'm supported by. It's the people around me, and they either help me or they hinder me. So I start with, let's look at you as a person, who's around you, who affects you, and we go from there.
412-246-2002. Let's go to Fred in Murraysville, who has a question. Fred, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. Yeah, I have a question regarding what role, have there been a serious look at, what role self-discipline plays in this? Because I honestly think that is a huge factor with access, easier access to food, and it's easy to overeat, and seems to be less discipline involved with pushing yourself away from the table, and this need to just consume more, and then exercise requires effort and work, and people, it's easier to be lazy. So self-discipline, I think, is a huge factor in this, and I'd be interested in hearing your views on that.
Well, my views are, I agree with where you're going, Fred, but I think you have to go back to the fact that that's a very hard thing to measure, and I'm not aware of anything statistically correct that's going to give me an answer for you. The point of the matter is that a lot of the studies that are out there that look at this whole idea of self-discipline are asking for anecdotal information. I mean, how do you measure somebody's self-discipline except ask them? And I'm going to tell you what I want you to hear, not necessarily what is real. So I know of no studies right now. On the other side of it all, it isn't as simple as just self-discipline. And when you look at the multifaceted area of obesity, we still don't know why a person, shall we say, craves, wants to go back for more than they need, wants to be uncomfortably full. There are a lot of multifaceted reasons. So it's not as simple as push yourself away from the table, even though as a dietitian, I might very well say that's a start.
How much of this is psychological? For example, if someone's been told all their life, clean your plate, and if you put the food on the plate, then you have to eat it. Or if someone grew up in a household where there wasn't enough food, and now the idea of turning away any food is too much to bear.
You're calling it psychological. I'm calling it cultural. It's the same thing. If you grow up in a family where food is at risk, you're quite right. The idea is get to it fast and eat it down because you may starve. The other side of it all, for years we knew of the fact that, eat your food because somebody is dying of starvation somewhere in a third world country. And that still is a pervasive attitude. So I see it as how we view food and how we view the role of food in our life. Food is supposed to be nourishment. Stop and think about it. Why do you eat?
Why do I eat?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like a lot of people, there's a certain pleasure you get out of something that tastes good.
Does hunger come into it, though, if you see a certain pleasure of something out there?
I would say for the most part, but I think we've all let's be honest. I think we've all gone back for something that we knew we didn't need. So one of the things that I've heard people recommend, like yourself, is that you need to think of food differently and as more of something that is sustenance and less as this pleasurable thing that you're indulging in.
And on the standpoint of, I don't want you to give up the pleasure, okay? That's not the point. The point really is you're eating to provide your body with the energy it needs and the nutrients it needs. Now, I know that sounds pretty doggone basic, but that's what you're eating for. On the other side, food has such a meaning in our society that, I mean, would you really celebrate your birthday by blowing out the candles on a piece of carrots? I mean, would that give you the same pleasure, the same enjoyment? I don't want you to give up the culture of the enjoyment of food. What I want you to do is be realistic about how much is reasonable for you to indulge in at any one time. And think of food as what it is, a fuel, an energy, but also something that is a very much a part of our life.
412-246-2002 if you have a comment or question for our guest, Judy Dodd of Pitt School of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences. If someone is going to have the surgery that we were talking mm-hmm. about, what steps should they take?
Well, the first thing is you need to follow the directions of the surgeon and the team. And the team should include a registered dietitian because what we're talking about here is a lifetime change. The surgery is only the beginning. From that point on, you're going to have to address the exercise and food choices for the rest of your life. Surgery is only a quick start for changing the next step. And a lot of people look at it as, well, if I have the surgery, I'm done. Uh-uh. So be prepared mentally for the fact that you're going to be changing your food choices, when you eat, what you eat, how you exercise, because physically, your body is going to react differently to food. That's an important part. On the other side of it all, if you're going to have the surgery, my hope would be there is a team there that does include somebody that's going to give you the psychological counseling you need, as well as the physical counseling that you need, as well as the nutrition and medical counseling. So I would see the team should prepare you. It's not something you're going to do on your own.
Do you have a different approach to nutrition with children as opposed to adults?
Absolutely. My approach and anybody's approach for children has to go back to, again, the caregivers. The role modeling that happens in the school, in the daycare, in the home, wherever they are. Children are pretty much a captive audience until they get to that point where they can buy their own food or access their own food. They're going to eat whatever in their environment. So from my standpoint, I'm not working just with a child. I'm working with the family. You can't say, here, Johnny, this is yours and this is mommy and daddy's, or this belongs to grandma or whoever.
And you do supermarket tours for families.
I do supermarket tours. I've been part of several obesity studies, and my major role was to walk a family, and by a family unit, it's one adult, one child, through that market, and let's look at what choices might be the better choice. And again, it's not giving up something, it's which is the better choice, or how much of it can we really afford to include.
412-246-2002, we're running short on time, but let's take one more call from Cannon in Bellevue. Cannon, I hope I have that right.
No, my name's Ken.
Ken, okay. Ken. It says Cannon here on the screen.
No, okay.
So maybe that was like a nickname because you're a powerful guy. But you had a question.
Yeah, I have a comment also on with your guest there. I'm 64 years old, and when I was a kid growing up, I've never been overweight, never had a problem with diabetes or anything like that, and didn't know a whole lot of people who did.
And Ken, we're very short on time, so if you could just get right to your question.
Okay. My question concerns the quality of the food that's available to us today. Mm-hmm. I can't help but think that the quality of the food, it's just not as nutritional as it was when I was a kid. And that adds a lot, I think, to the problem. Do you agree?
I am total agreement with you, and I always use the term cook, C-O-O-K, is not a four-letter word. It's not wrong to learn to take ingredients and turn them into a food. We depend far more on other people doing the preparation for us. As a result, some of those foods are higher in fat, higher in some other items that we may want to avoid that may not be the best choice. And you, for as a dietitian, I go for nutrient density and recognize that a calorie is not a calorie. You really have to look at the quality of those calories. So I would agree that it is back to some simple preparation, back to understanding what food's supposed to be. That doesn't mean you can't have processed. It doesn't mean that you can't have food out. It simply means know your food.
Judy Dodd of Pitt School of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. You can catch the entire show online at WESA.FM or as a podcast in iTunes. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We'll see you with another edition of Essential Pittsburgh.